Good morning. Excuse me. Dave Kindop appearing on behalf of Appellant Robert Forrest. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I might. One of the primary issues on appeal before this court is whether or not Mr. Forrest is precluded from pursuing his federal civil rights action against Officer Higdon in the Fort Bragg Police Department based on the doctrine of collateral estoppel. Obviously, Mr. Forrest contends that that doctrine does not preclude him from pursuing his claims in this case, and primarily it's because he contends he did not receive a full and fair opportunity in the state trial court proceedings to litigate the issue of the probable cause for his arrest. And one of the issues I would like to discuss today is perhaps some clarification with respect to one of the points that I attempted to make in the briefs that were filed with this court. And that is what happened at the hearing on the petition for the finding of factual innocence and the relationship between that hearing and the other state trial court proceedings.
The earlier ones.
The earlier ones, in particular the earlier ones. Obviously, the procedural history is important in that Mr. Forrest was charged. There was a preliminary hearing. He was held over at that preliminary hearing to stand trial. And about 8 months thereafter, all of the criminal charges against him were dismissed. About 8 months thereafter, he filed a petition for a finding of factual innocence, which is a very specific statutory procedure that's authorized in California for a person such as Mr. Forrest to litigate the issue as to whether or not there was probable cause for his arrest. And if he's successful in convincing the trial court judge that there was not probable cause for the crime for which he was arrested, his record would be what's commonly referred to as expunged. That being, his arrest record would be expunged and there'd be a finding that he was factually innocent. Now, the relationship between what happened at that hearing and what happened at the prior hearings, I think, is very important, because what we contend, by way of, I think, logic and common sense, because I couldn't find any authority that addresses this issue, is that because that particular hearing is designed to address that particular issue, it should control that particular issue, meaning, was there probable cause for his arrest?
So forgive me, but you said that particular about four times, so I just need to
be clear.
No problem. Just to be clear, you're talking about the factual innocence hearing.
Yes.
And that particular issue is whether or not there was probable cause.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. And because what comes out of that hearing will necessarily, I think, supersede anything that happened previously, that being what's tantamount to a finding of probable cause because he's bound over for trial. Additionally, the trial court appeal of the binding over for trial, which is the 995 motion to dismiss the information. And I think logic and common sense dictate that that is the hearing that we need to focus on for purposes of deciding whether or not Mr. Forrest was afforded a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue of probable cause for his arrest.
Well, okay. But he had lots of different opportunities, and you're saying you want to focus on the one hearing. How was it deficient? How was it unfair?
That hearing was unfair because under California law, Mr. Forrest not only has the right to file that petition and have an evidentiary hearing on that petition, but he's also allowed to submit relevant, reliable, and material evidence in support of his petition, which includes the calling of live testimony, the calling of live witnesses. And at that particular hearing, Mr. Forrest had subpoenaed a witness to testify, and that witness was David A. or David Allen Paoli. And as is indicated from the record, Mr. Forrest intended to call Mr. Paoli as a witness, and he would have provided material evidence to the trial court's determination of the issue of probable cause.
But wouldn't his testimony have been that the, I'm going to say victim, understanding that your contention is that he wasn't a victim, but forgive me, that the victim may have had a mental health history?
He would have testified that the victim did in fact have a significant mental health history, and that the victim had a history of engaging in aggressive behavior when he didn't take his medication, and the month prior to the altercation between Mr. Douglas and Mr. Forrest, Mr. Douglas has actually threatened David Allen Paoli with a splitting maul, which is a large axe.
Right. So all of that would have been relevant if I look at this in the light most favorable to your client, to the issue about whether or not the victim was actually the aggressor in this underlying incident. But the fact finder that was making the decision about whether or not there was probable cause also had eyewitness testimony that your client had held him by the shirt and pointed a gun at him. And the question was whether or not there was probable cause to find an assault, right?
Yes, and I think my answer is twofold. The first is that the court did have limited eyewitness testimony, that being from Mr. Long. But Mr. Long only saw the very end of the incident by his own testimony. He didn't see what led up to Mr. Forrest having to pull out his firearm to protect himself.
There's another point that I'd like you to address, and it seems to me that there can be probable cause for an arrest even if ultimately self-defense is demonstrated. That is, the arresting officers are not a trial to sort out everything. They might see an altercation and arrest both people and sort it out later as to who might have been the aggressor and who might not. And I guess I have difficulty understanding how, even if you were to prove that there was self-defense here, how that negates probable cause for the initial arrest.
That's a very interesting point, Judge Graber. And I think the answer to the question is the procedure that's allowed under California law with respect to the petition for finding of factual innocence and what evidence can be submitted at that hearing. I think
no, my question isn't at all about evidence. My question is a theoretical one, that even if you'd shown everything you could possibly show at that hearing, I don't understand how it negates probable cause to arrest. I, in other words, I guess I don't see how any of those facts could make that proceeding come out differently, because probable cause to arrest doesn't require that you for sure negate self-defense in order to be able to arrest somebody.
I believe that self-defense does negate the probable cause to arrest, because if he was acting in self-defense, there was no basis for his arrest. And as I was probably slowly getting to before, what state law allows with respect to the presentation of evidence that hearing is evidence that's acquired after arrest, evidence that's acquired after the case is dismissed, to negate that probable cause. And so it's an interesting dynamic, but that statute and the case law interpreting it does allow the submission of evidence that's acquired after arrest to negate probable cause.
We have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, and we have considered your proffer about everything that excluded testimony would have shown, and I still don't understand how it would have negated a finding of probable cause, given the eyewitness testimony.
Because the trial court was missing a critical piece of evidence. That was Mr. Douglas's mental health history. It was missing evidence that he didn't take his medication, and it was missing evidence that he acted aggressively, heard voices, and acted out violently and threatened people with physical violence when he doesn't take his medication.
Right. And all that could have shown that the quote-unquote victim was the aggressor during this incident, right?
Correct.
Could it have shown something else? Am I missing some other import?
Well, it could have shown that he was the aggressor and that Mr. Forrest reasonably believed that he needed to exhibit his firearm to protect himself, which would be self-defense.
Right. Go ahead.
Did the state court at the factual innocence hearing accept the declaration of David Eugene Paoli?
The trial court did not receive a portion of David Eugene Paoli's declaration.
What about the portion that described David Allen Paoli's experiences with Mr. Douglas?
That is the specific portion of the declaration that the court did not receive. The court sustained the people's objection to that evidence, and anticipating that the trial court might do that, Mr. Forrest's attorney subpoenaed David Allen Paoli to come in and testify as to those facts, because he did have personal knowledge as to those facts, and so that's why he was there. But the trial court Judge Henderson, declined the opportunity to receive that testimony. And based on my recollection of the record, it was because Mr. Forrest's counsel didn't give some sort of advance notice of his intent to call live witnesses, but I'm not aware of any requirement that that be done. And the state of the law was pretty clear at the time of this hearing that live witness testimony was allowed. So I'm not quite sure, looking at the record, why Judge Henderson didn't let Mr. Paoli testify, but we do have a good offer of proof, and I think the record is pretty clear as to what David Allen Paoli would have testified to. And I think it probably would have materially affected Judge Henderson's decision, because if you've looked at Judge Henderson's decision at that hearing or after that hearing, he specifically indicated that Mr. Forrest had initially met his threshold burden of demonstrating that there was not probable cause for his arrest. However, he then found, after the burden had shifted to the people, that the people had proved that there was probable cause. And according to Judge Henderson's ruling, that was pretty much exclusively based on the preliminary hearing testimony, which we've also taken issue with, because the people offered that evidence in opposition to Mr. Forrest's petition, but there was testimony within Mr. Douglas's testimony at the preliminary hearing that was materially false, and especially with respect to his mental health history. He specifically denied that he had any significant history of mental health problems. He had indicated that he'd only recently seen a mental health practitioner. He denied that he was taking any medication for any mental health issues. So the court, in theory, received evidence that was materially false that really should have never been offered to begin with. And then the only other testimony that the court would have had that would have been the testimony from Mr. Long, who only saw the very end of the incident. So I think that if Judge Henderson had received David Allen Paoli's testimony and heard about his mental health history, heard about the problems that he had with him just the month prior, where he threatened to physically harm him with the splitting maul, which is corroborated by the fact that David Eugene Paoli had seen him actually walking around his property with it, I think that would have materially affected Judge Henderson's decision. And so I think it comes down to whether or not this court has sufficient confidence in what happened in the state trial court proceedings such that Mr. Forrest should not be allowed to pursue what he believes to be a very, very important case, in that he wants the opportunity to prove that his civil rights were violated by this officer, and that the Fort Bragg Police Department is also liable for that officer's behavior.
Did you want to save some rebuttal time?
I did.
About 2 minutes. And a little
I will save that time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. William Mitchell for Defendant Higdon. Also here is Mr. Hinkles for the city. We've decided to divide our time. I'll try to keep my eye on the clock here and yield to Mr. Hinkle after about 8 minutes. If this case were allowed to proceed to trial in district court, the dispositive issue would be whether, based on the collective knowledge of the investigating officers, there was probable cause to arrest a plaintiff for assault with a deadly weapon. The complaint alleges that Defendant Higdon ordered the arrest of plaintiff based on the information he received from the eyewitness Jacob Long and from Stanley Douglas. The judge at the preliminary hearing found that there was probable cause to hold plaintiff over for trial based on precisely the same evidence that was available to Higdon, the statements of Long and Stanley. So we have the identity of issues here. In other words, a trial in the district court would simply be a replay of the issues repeatedly decided against plaintiff in multiple states.
So is your collateral estoppel claim based on the preliminary hearing or the factual innocence hearing or both?
I would say the factual innocence hearing is simply an independent proceeding which has independent support for collateral estoppel. The court in McCutcheon clearly held that the findings in the preliminary hearing are binding and conclusive, so we would submit that the preliminary hearing alone is sufficient for collateral estoppel. As for the fabrication of evidence issue, it wasn't addressed by the plaintiff. The complaint against Higdon is basically that he fabricated police reports. The alleged reports played no part in the determination of probable cause by the state court judges. The issue of the alleged falsified report was raised at the preliminary hearing, and the judge repeatedly stated that he would not and did not consider any police reports, that he was basing his findings only on the eyewitness testimony. So the allegation that Higdon falsified police reports is simply not part of the probable cause equation. It's irrelevant. And in terms of the full and fair opportunity arguments, basically breaks down to two parts. Mr. Hinkle was going to address this in more detail. I will go over it briefly. The claim is that he was not provided a full and fair opportunity because Sergeant Lee's testimony was excluded. This issue was specifically addressed three times in the courts below, which determined that the plaintiff was not prejudiced based on the offer of proof made, which was that the plaintiff told Lee that Douglas used offensive language during the encounter in face of the undisputed testimony that plaintiff was holding a gun to Mr. Douglas's head while holding onto his clothing and yelling at him, I think shows the propriety of that ruling to exclude evidence in terms of aggressive language.
Counsel, what is there, had he been successful at the actual innocence hearing, what is there to expunge from his record? Does his record show that he was arrested and the charges were dismissed, or what does it show?
I'm not sure of that, Your Honor. I'm not sure what it says.
Okay.
And in terms of David A. Paoli, again, I don't think it goes to the issue of probable cause, which is based on the knowledge of the officers at the time of the arrest. This proposed testimony was to be that a month earlier, Douglas had allegedly threatened Mr. Paoli with an axe or something. Again, not relevant to the issue of probable cause, which is a termination based on the information known to the officers at the time of the arrest. Furthermore, plaintiff fails to explain why he didn't offer the testimony of David A. Paoli at the preliminary hearing. He had full and fair opportunity to fully litigate the issue of probable cause there, and he does not explain why he was not called at that hearing. And with that, it looks like my time's about up. I'll turn it over to Mr. Hinkles.
You may do that. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Hinkles. I'm here on behalf of the City of Fort Bragg and the Fort Bragg Police Department. I would like to take this opportunity in the middle of these proceedings to remind everyone that we are here. This is now the eighth court that has reviewed the issues that the appellant here is bringing. The district court was the seventh court. The district court appropriately declined review on the grounds that it has been well litigated in several state courts and that federal review is therefore improper. I think one of the remarkable things about this case is the extent of the record, given the amount of times that the appellant has actually litigated the issue of probable cause. And what that allows us at this point is to be able to tell from the record and from the allegations that are contained in plaintiff's complaint that each of the elements necessary to establish collateral estoppel with respect to the issue of probable cause have been more than met. That's true as a matter of law, and that's true, and therefore makes collateral estoppel appropriate in this circumstance. I would like to address one of the questions you asked my co-counsel here. You had asked Judge Thunheim that the whether or not we were seeking that the factual innocent hearing or the preliminary hearing could establish collateral estoppel for the issue of probable cause. The issue here is actually that both do. The preliminary hearing does, because as set forth in McCutcheon, it has the same quantum of evidence necessary to prove whether the trial should go forward or whether he can prevail on his civil rights claim.
Let me clarify one thing. When you say both do you mean each independently is sufficient, or do you mean that we need to amalgamate the two?
Well, I mean that as the appellant has admitted during his oral argument, the petition for factual innocence decision by Judge Henderson and then the California Court of Appeal decision both relied upon the evidence that was presented.
Okay, I need a more precise answer to my question. Are you arguing that the preliminary hearing is sufficient for claim preclusion, and also separately that the factual innocence hearing suffices for claim preclusion, or are you arguing that we need to put them together in order to find preclusion?
I'm arguing that each are separately
okay, thank you.
Sufficient for claim preclusion.
Okay, thank you.
And I think that the petition for factual innocence, especially because in that case it was a plaintiff's burden to prove that there was no reasonable cause, and each court that reviewed that issue reviewed the preliminary hearing transcript and the evidence that was presented there that established that Robert Forrest had pointed a gun at an unarmed man and had yelled obscenities at him. And they reviewed that transcript, and they determined that probable cause existed.
Do you have an answer to Judge Kristen's earlier question about what would happen if, I think this was her question, about what would have happened had the factual innocence hearing been successful, what might have been different about his record?
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding is that his record would have been expunged, meaning that there would be no longer on any CLET reports that he was arrested or that he was arraigned, and any kind of charges that were brought would be dismissed. So any time anyone would search his record, that would no longer be a part of any of the reports.
And what does it show now? Just that he was arrested and that no charges were filed or no charges were taken to trial?
I haven't reviewed it personally, Your Honor, but that would be my assumption. And that would be my assumption only based upon the fact that he tried so hard to get that expunged, that currently there must be something on there right now that he didn't.
That shows that he was arrested, at least.
Yes.
Okay.
And had he been able to prove that his arrest was without reasonable cause, he would have been able to get the relief that he sought. He was not able to do that, and that was decided against him. I think in this case, amazingly too, as is well established, collateral estoppel in this matter applies based upon California law. And I do think I would want to point out something that the appellant had been raising with respect to the whether he actually litigated had an opportunity to actually litigate his proceedings. I think this is kind of a remarkable argument, but his whole claims with respect to the David Paolis, whether it's David E. Paoli or David A. Paoli, is irrelevant before this court. The issue had been raised to the state court at the petition for factual innocence. The court made a decision based upon California law. That decision was appealed to the California Court of Appeals. He then petitioned for review from the California Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. So that decision, whatever decision that was made with respect to David Paoli A or E, is final now. The federal courts have stated repeatedly that they're not courts of appeal for California procedural law. There's no necessary civil right that's implicated there. So I don't think that argument is necessarily appropriate.
Well, I don't think I understand what you're telling me. Do you think that testimony of the Paolis was irrelevant to the whether there was probable cause on the underlying incident, or are you telling me that procedurally the denial of the ability to call those witnesses is now irrelevant for purposes of the decision we have to make.
Well, both of those things are true, Your Honor. It's certainly true that it's irrelevant with respect to the probable cause determination.
Why?
Because the issue for the probable cause determination was whether a reasonable person would consider that a crime had likely been committed. The evidence before the court was, the evidence before the fact finder was that Mr. Forrest was pointing a gun at an unarmed man, and while he was doing so, he was screaming at him. The unarmed man was very scared.
It seems to me absolutely relevant to know what the circumstances were at the time and who was the original aggressor.
It is relevant, Your Honor, but it's not determinative of the outcome.
Yes, but you said it was irrelevant. That's why I'm belaboring the point. Forgive me.
My apologies, Your Honor. With respect to your second question, it is irrelevant because that issue has been decided. The issue is now precluded from being raised again. So since the competent tribunal has rendered its decision on that issue, whether or not you could introduce testimony at the preliminary hearing of David A. or E. Paoli, has been decided, has been reviewed, and has been finally determined. So for purposes of this court and what is before this court at this time, that issue is now precluded, and appellant is not allowed entitled to raise it. And I think also to go back over the issues that are before this court, which is whether or not collateral estoppel applies, which I think it clearly does. I think it's very important that the record is considerable and the allegations of the complaint establishes the very basis that the issues to be litigated at the preliminary hearing and the petition for factual innocence, because those were the same issues, are the very issues that establish collateral estoppel. In other words, the plaintiff alleges in his complaint that the police interviewed each of the witnesses who testified at the preliminary hearing before his arrest. Those witnesses testified as to what they told the police. The reviewer, the magistrate judge at that hearing, listened to the testimony of those witnesses and determined on an independent basis that probable cause existed to arrest Mr. Forrest for assault with a deadly weapon. That issue was reviewed by another court and ultimately reviewed by three more courts.
Mr. Hinkles, I wanted to ask you a question about the mildly interesting Brady claim in this case. Normally a Brady claim is an argument that the jury verdict would have been different but for the government misconduct. Here, I think the argument is that the result of the preliminary hearing would have been different but for the government misconduct. Why is this different?
Your Honor, this is different because Brady versus Maryland is specifically addressed to protect a party's rights at trial. It is not the right to have exculpatory information provided to you is not attached to every single proceeding that the government may bring against you. For example, you don't need exculpatory information when you file a criminal complaint either. The preliminary hearing is one of those safeguards for the criminal defendant to make sure that the probable cause exists to hold him over for trial. So that in itself is its own safeguard. The Supreme Court's decision in that case just simply doesn't apply to preliminary hearings or pretty much any other hearing except for the trial itself. And it's actually questionable whether or not, as in the cases that were cited in the brief, it's questionable whether or not you actually need a verdict in order for that case to apply.
Counsel, a preliminary hearing wouldn't be much of a safeguard if there were evidence, and perhaps this isn't the case, but if we had a case where it was clear that the police had withheld significant evidence before a preliminary hearing, that hearing would give me pretty cold comfort about the reasonableness of the determination.
Correct. Well, let me reassure you in this case, Your Honor, that there is no allegation. But the allegation that he's actually making with respect to the exculpatory information was the history of Mr. Stanley Douglas and the issue on the police report were both raised at the preliminary hearing, so they clearly were not withheld in this case.
Is there any authority, going back to Judge Thunheim's question about the scope, what I'll call the procedural scope or the applicability of Brady outside of trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the cases we cite in the brief were...
I guess what I should have said, a better question would have been, what's the case that's the most comparable to what we've got?
Right. It is Smith versus Almada, Your Honor.
Okay.
Which we had originally cited in our motion to dismiss. Originally, that decision had stated specifically that a trial is necessary, or a verdict is actually necessary to state out a plausible claim for withholding of exculpatory evidence in violation of Brady versus Maryland. In that case, had pretty extreme facts. There were two entire trials, and the first trial ended up in a hung jury, and they tried it the second time. And the argument on the civil rights claim was that had you provided me information before the first trial, I wouldn't have had to sat in jail between this entire time between these two trials. The Ninth Circuit, in reviewing that case, initially had stated that you cannot state a Brady claim because there was no actual verdict, and the Brady versus Maryland upholds the integrity of the verdict. They reviewed that, and they withdrew the Ninth Circuit reviewed its decision because it determined that making that decision in that case was not necessarily because, under other grounds, the plaintiff could not make out a Brady versus Maryland claim.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Kindup, you have a little bit of rebuttal time remaining. I want to ask you a question regarding this, the Brady issue. What, in your view, it was withheld from you or from your predecessor in interest before the time of the preliminary hearing?
I think what was withheld was information concerning Mr. Douglas's mental health history.
You didn't have that before the preliminary hearing?
No. We acquired that through our own defense investigation.
Did you have that before the factual innocence hearing?
Yes, and that's the evidence that Mr. Okay. Forrest specifically tried to introduce, which he wasn't allowed to introduce erroneously because the state of the law is very clear that he was entitled to present that evidence to the judge deciding that
did
issue.
Did the police have it?
Pardon me?
Did the police have it?
I believe the police did have it, and I know that from my knowledge of the case.
Does the record show that the police had it? Because Brady applies only to things that are within, or the government had it, or some other portion of the government might count.
I will say yes and no, in the sense that there is evidence in the record that the police were aware of it, and I believe that that was the report from Investigator Sheehan that the trial court actually refused to consider, and that was an interview by Private Investigator Sheehan of a former Fort Bragg police officer, I believe his name is Yeomans, who said it was well known that this man had a history of mental illness because they were constantly dealing with him, and in fact, any time he was involved in an incident, they dispatched multiple officers.
Okay, next question is...
Yes.
I know that you disagree with the proposition that there was no prejudice from the exclusion of this information, but do you agree in principle that prejudice is a required element of a Brady claim, that some showing of prejudice is required to sustain a Brady claim?
I believe there has to be some prejudice. Otherwise,
what's
in essence,
point?
What's the
right,
point? Exactly,
right.
Yes. what I'd like to point out to the court is, in looking at this procedural context that we're in with respect to what happened in the trial court, is what would have happened if Judge Henderson had granted the petition for a finding of factual innocence and found there was no probable cause for arrest? Where does that leave the holding order after the preliminary hearing? Would the defendant still be contending that collateral estoppel applies because there was a holding order at the preliminary hearing, even though Judge Henderson subsequently entered a ruling indicating there was no probable cause for arrest? That's one of the reasons why, logically, that particular hearing has to take precedence and has to supersede the holding order or the order that was issued after the 995 hearing. Now,
Your time has expired. If you have a sentence or two to wrap up, you're
I
welcome
just have,
to do that.
One sentence, which is that the factual determination for Judge Henderson at the time of the petition for finding of factual innocence is not limited to what the officers knew at the time of the arrest. That's why the rule is really clear. It's all evidence that's available at the time of the hearing, which includes evidence that's gathered after the time of the arrest and even after the time of the prosecution.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the arguments that all three of you have brought to us. The case just argued is submitted, and we are adjourned.